S O so why did they fire you?
Oh, because they had a rule called nepotism. And nepotism means that somebody gets an unfair advantage. Someone gets a job because they're married to somebody or they're relatives with somebody. And we didn't know there was such a rule. Nobody knew that. And in the 60s, nobody got married. But we did. We went to Mexico, and on the spur of the moment, we got married. We wouldn't have done it if we knew I was going to get fired.
And because Dennis was a faculty member.
But see, I had been an undergraduate at Berkeley, and I'd gone through my 4 years of undergraduate, and then I was a graduate student. He came in as a brand new assistant prof when I met him, and that was my sixth year in Berkeley. Now, how could he have gotten me my job?
Right.
You could argue I did.
Right. That ain't nepotism?
No. But they thought it was. I went to the union. You know, Berkeley was unionized. AFL-CIO, AFT. And they forced them to hire me to keep me on and to hire me for one more year. But said I was a disgrace to the university.
Who said that? The university said that you were a disgrace?
I was a disgrace.
And why were you a disgrace?
Because I'd been sleeping with a faculty member who I married.
Wow.
Pretty weird, huh?
Yeah.
For those times, late 60s.
But the union... The UN, I, V, the universe, university, is always two, 20 years behind the times.
It is. It always is.
You E M emailed you emailed me that is how we met.
Right.
Why did you, email me?
You have a great site. I found your site. It's great. It's one of the most interesting ones out there.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he said he liked mine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's not as sophisticated as his, but it's not bad.
What did you like about Frank's site?
Very complicated, beautiful, lots of things going on.
Mikey does all the
websites.
He
does the websites.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Just you would never get bored looking at his website, whereas other websites are dull.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Isn't that a P A a part? Of S H A shamanism?
Yes. To always be interesting and have a lot going on.
Yes. I was and C O N N connected? No, connecting.
Connecting.
Things.
Mm-hmm. You are. And you do. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. I am. No, I. Always. W. O. Wonder. M. I. Really? A. Shaman?
Hmm. Mm. Looked like it to me.
How so?
The intensity. You know, shamans are intense people.
I have never studied with anyone.
Right.
In a
formal
way.
Right.
But then most shamans?
It varies. Some shamans study with the spirit and don't have a teacher. Other shamans go through formal training. My husband and I went through formal training with the Maya in Guatemala. They have a regular way of training people. But the spirits trained us too. But some people never have a formal training. You know, they learn it all from the spiritual world.
In the 70s? No, in the 80s.
80s.
People? F. R. From. M. A. R. Marin County.
Marin County.
K. Kept. C. A. Calling. Me. And asking who I studied with. A. As if they would know the person if I had studied with them and gave them a name.
Well, is this Michael Harner? He lives in Marin County. Maybe that's why.
No, it was just people that had seen flyers and were thinking about getting involved in Frank's work, but first they wanted to know who he had studied with. And he always thought, like, well, what if I had studied with somebody as if they would know the name, if I kind of gave them a name, as if, like, shamans that you study with are well-known. She, it, is not like on in the W.E.S. Western E.D. education system.
Right. It's different.
Yeah. Where you study with a F.A. famous teacher.
Teacher.
Who you then A can I N I M P R impress people with
who I studied with, right? Yeah. Right.
I S A I said L-I, life.
Mm. Life.
Yeah.
The best teacher.
Yeah. They did not like that answer.
They weren't shamans. That's a good answer.
Mm-hmm. In they, G, O, they got, P, I, pissed off.
Right. In the 80s.
Huh? Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
That is what when it all CH
changed.
That's our experience that that we started to find that people related to each other differently.
In the 80s.
Sometime in the 80s it all shifted.
Yes.
One of the ways we discovered it, Frank used to go out. He had a motorized chair. And from the time he moved to Berkeley in 75 until this point in the mid-80s, he'd just go out every day in his motorized chair, and he'd have a bag on his back of his chair filled with his writings and pictures of whatever we were doing at the time. And then he'd have a sign taped to the board, whatever his latest, as he's called it, con was. Do you want to be in my movie? Do you want to da-da-da? And he'd just wheel up to people.
And people said yes.
Just, yeah, they were just like happy. They'd sit there with him for an hour and look through the back of the binder. And he'd come home with a bag full of phone numbers. We did a video called Erotic Play for, we shot it for about a year and a half. And Frank's idea was, I want to do a video that show people as beautiful just by being themselves rather than the Hollywood kind of picture of beauty. And I was like, oh, Frank, you're not going to get people to sign up for this. But he went out and he would come home with bags of phone numbers. And so we would shoot like 8-9 hours a day, 2 hours a person.
Exhausting.
But it was so fun. Wonderful. It wasn't exhausting at that point, eh? Mm-hmm. It was amazing because we had a little garage that was kind of converted into a studio, sort of, and we had a trunk full of costumes and a foam mat. My cave. Frank called it his cave.
Right.
And it would just be Frank and I. I'd be have the camera, and Frank would be there talking to people.
To these people.
He'd say, just try the costumes on and have fun and play. And what happened was that it got very intimate. People would start crying. They would start telling us about their lives. And it seemed like there was a feeling of intimacy and of us all being the same that seemed to activate something deeper in people. So it turned into another whole movie. It was like more a documentary of that experience. But then by the mid-80s...
It was over.
When he would go up to people, they would kind of be weirded out that they didn't know him and he was approaching them. Like, what do you want? P-O-R. Oh, and then they'd look at the work and they'd say, oh, it looks like porn because it was nudity.
Right.
You know, so that was the end of that phase.
Have you noticed a change recently? Is it improving?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways it has. B, E, because the R, E, repression is more. Much more. So, people are searching, they're seeking for an alternative to that.
Yeah.
Like, we did A, S, E, E, S-E, R, a series at at UCB. Mm-hmm. Was that like a year and a half ago or something like that?
Last year, maybe.
I-S-H-I-S-N sneak in everywhere. Yeah, well, we got the series originally was supposed to be sponsored by the art department there because we had found out that the art department and the theater department both taught about Frank. And then art department, one of the teachers, started inviting Frank to be a guest in her class and paying us. And this was like, what a great gig. But so Frank always kind of pushes everything. You know, we could have really rode on this gig for quite a long time. But instead he started saying, would you sponsor a series if I did a performance series? Because she's teaching about his performances. So he's thinking, you know, B, E, because we had done a series at UCB in the 70s. It was the early 80s. And for 3.5 years before the change.
Before the change.
Yeah. And it was an amazing series. We were sponsored by the student union, I can never remember, ASUC Studio. ASUC Studio. The head of that knew Frank's work. He had seen at one of our shows, and he said he thought Frank's work was to the 80s what LSD was to the 60s. And he thought students should be exposed and have an opportunity.
Oh, that's great.
So he stood behind us even when the campus police showed up and said, why is Frank nude laying on the table in a classroom? He said, it's performance art and we're sponsoring it. You know, so that was the first one. So we knew we were like set. And we did that for 3.5 years till he quit his job and went to learn cooking in Italy or something. And so we've been trying to we've been trying to find something ever since. And then this teacher,
opened it up.
So she said she'd love to. And we got it all set up. We had dates for like the whole semester. And then the week that the first grab that paper. The week that the first one was scheduled, this cover story in the East Bay Express came out on Frank.
And this was the cover.
And there's nudity throughout. They published all these pictures.
That's terrific.
We were really impressed.
So what year is this?
Is it 2003?
Yeah.
I think so.
So there's a opening up again.
That.
A little bit of an opening.
Right. That was.
That's a terrific cover.
Yes. That was on. It was on every corner, you know, the way this paper is.
We
would drive down San Pablo into Oakland and see ourselves on all the corners and just love it.
That's wonderful.
Well, meanwhile, the head of the art department freaked out. This isn't the story we were told. We were told that for bureaucratic reasons, it turns out that she couldn't sponsor
it. But she actually freaked out.
Right. But it was. But what we found out when we called someone we knew in the theater department was that it was the head of the department saw this and said, no way do we have this on campus. And so it was a quick one. You know, we did one performance. The place was packed, and we realized that something had changed because
it was a
room full of people, and it really didn't feel like it had to do with us. It was like people were just craving what this was that we were putting out. And it was like, wow, you know, this is great. And then we get hit by this, you know, the couple days after the first one. And we talked to the teacher in the theater department who had at one point said, oh, you see, people don't use all those empty rooms. When I was in New York, there was never an empty room on the campuses. So we call him and say, hey, we need a sponsor. He says, you should get a student. They have less to lose. So all of a sudden, he doesn't want to have anything to do with us.
How interesting. So it looked possible.
It looked possible. But, and then we had been in a censorship battle with the city right before that over public access. They wanted they wanted our show off. The city council wanted our show off and another show that we sponsored off. And we had to fight, and we fought for almost a year. Frank was in the paper practically every day.
Did you get a lawyer? Or
the ACLU came on their own and addressed the city council. That's the point it disappeared. It disappeared. But we had spent like 9 months really focused on fighting this, going to a lot of city council meetings. But anyway, during that, we had met this young, punky-looking gal who was doing her doctorate at UC. And as she's going up to speak to the city council on her own issue, she whispers to Frank, "I love your show on public access." So, of course, I had to get her phone number. Yeah. So now we call her, and we say, we need a sponsor. And we told her the whole story. She said, "Oh, I love to sponsor things the university doesn't want on campus." Turns out she had all these bogus student groups that she was part of just for things like this. And so she sponsored us. She was our sponsor for
what an interesting
I think it was
story.
Like 8 or 9 months we did it until she left school. Yeah. We did the kind of performances we did. Yeah, well, we were there probably twice a month for that period of time in a classroom. Mm. We transformed the classroom. We have all these painted backdrops that Monkey has done.
Like here.
Right.
Yeah.
And we would have, Frank would just, we'd invite all the various musicians and artists that we knew, and people would just show up, and Frank would make something up on the spot based
happening.
On who was there. Mm. Yeah. And we, the erotic stuff we did got very explicit, and we were taping everything and playing it on public access. So we enjoyed the fact that we were doing it on the university after they didn't want us. We had snuck on the university, and then we were putting it on television. So we weren't, we weren't hiding anything, but nobody could do anything because we had already fought the censorship stuff with the city.
With the city, yeah.
It was BU. It was building at the point that we lost our sponsorship. It was that community of people, and the people that came were so passionate about their experience of that it really was like something that was really making a difference in getting through their life, just the experience of being there. So it was disappointing when it kind of fizzled. So we didn't know at first that it was over.
That it was
over.
Fizzling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
B. E. Because. Her. P. R. E. R. S. Oh, I missed that one, sorry. Her P-E-R-S-O,
personal
life. It was because of her personal life. She was going through stuff, and so she couldn't deal with
it. She couldn't do it anymore.
She had to be there every time. That was part of the deal, and she was. So for those 9 months, she was at every performance we did, and she would
twice
participate.
A week?
Yeah.
Wow.
Twice a month. Yeah. Yeah,
that's
so she
commitment.
Was wonderful. Yeah, yeah, he was really wonderful.
Yeah.
What is S shamanism?
What is shamanism? Shamanism is it's an ancient tradition that's currently practiced by thousands of people all over the face of the earth. It's a growing tradition at this moment. It's a tradition that has been censored, people in Russia were sent to gulags for being shamans. Their tongues were cut out. Their drums were destroyed. They refused to stop. What they did was they went inside these circular tents and stopped using drums and shamanized only for people they knew in the dark without drums to keep it alive. And many of the shamans went to medical school in order to heal and to keep shamanic healing alive. And this went on for 70 years in the Soviet Union And it also went on in Mongolia, where Dennis and I have been and worked with shamans. And what was incredible was that the oppression couldn't stop shamanism, that it just went on quietly in small groups. And then during Glasnost in 1991-92, it began to open up. And by 1999, it went full public in front of television cameras. You see the power of something that's being censored to go public. They opened all their outside shrines. They put on their costumes. They had their drums, and they drummed. And many of them were university administrators, PhDs, lawyers, doctors who had been practicing and saving the tradition in their families. And they just went public. It was gorgeous. We were there, and it was just really stunning. And they opened earth shrines. So it's a very old healing tradition. It's a very old spiritual tradition that has been oppressed by every known religion, by Christianity, by Islam, by Judaism, by everything. Religion oppresses it, and communism oppressed it. But it survives.
Because it was
pre-religion. It's the root of all religion. It's the root of all medicine, all healing. Shamans were the healers. And so it's part of all of these traditions, but then it's been oppressed by all of them.
Where? When? The P-R-I-E
priests.
C-O-M come in that is when shamanism G-O goes underground.
Yes. The priests oppress it, and shamanism goes underground because the shaman has personal contact with the spiritual world.
Yes.
And doesn't need an intermediary, doesn't need a priest. And that's why priests don't like shamans, because we don't need them.
The shamans, the shaman, L, E, A, D, leads people, leads people to their own direct experience of spirit.
Right. The shaman is often a ceremonialist and helps people have their own experiences rather than having all the experience herself or himself.
Yes. But our religion is indirect.
Right. Whereas shamanism is direct spiritual contact with another reality.
Yes.
And you can have it all the time. You flip in and out of the various realities.
We are now doing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we talk about it.
I had a L A B O labor A C T activist.
Labor activist.
Mm. Oh, you're talking about letter carrier guy.
Mm. Ah.
Right. He's a letter carrier and he's a labor activist, particularly in the letter carrier union, but just labor in general. And he's a real kind of, you know, labor kind of guy. And and at some point, and he was a guest on the show. And at some point during the show, he said, "What are you doing, Frank?" or something like that. What? What is? What is this?
What is this?
V-I-O-V-O-V-O-O. What is this, voodoo?
Voodoo.
Because he started feeling, you know, something.
The power.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. He liked it. He liked it.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were recently in New Orleans, and I had never experienced voodoo shamanism before, and a friend there took us. And it was incredible to this performance at night. And voodoo is very much in the shamanic tradition. This was a particular temple in New Orleans, and it was astounding. It really was. And so I now know of another whole area of shamanism that I never knew about.
Linda, is reading Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee's autobiography. They're a couple. They're black and they're actors. Well, he just recently died. She's still alive, but they're well known in like movie and theater stuff. But they were also activists in the 60s. Like they hung out with Martin Luther King and did things like that. Are you talking about his dad? Right. So he lived in like the back hills in the South someplace. I don't remember what state. And this was, so he just died and he was in his 80s, so however long ago that was when he was a child. And his dad, he had a regular job, but what he was really doing and eventually quit his regular job and just did this was he was, I think they jokingly called him a witch doctor.
Oh.
But he knew, you know, the roots and the herbs and everything.
Root medicine.
Yeah, so he'd go and he'd make up stuff, and then he would just travel all over, be gone for like a week at a time and treat everybody. But it was more than just the roots. He'd sit with them. And he did like a, I guess, a Christian. He believed in Christianity. He was a Christian of some sort. So he did have a religious thing.
Right.
But he was the one that would cure everybody. And... yeah. S. So. I. Think. The. P. O. O. The poor. Have. M. O. More. C. O. Contact with shamanic experience.
I would say that's true. In Brazil, we were in Brazil, and they have shamanic religions like Candomblé, and the poor are very involved in that. And the poor are very involved in voodoo and very involved in shamanism. And they find it normal.
They don't go to M O modern medicine be because they can not S cannot A
afford it.
Afford it. But A L but also because S H shamanic W O works.
It does. Shamanism does work. Right. It heals. I had polio as a young child, and I ended up in a hospital in an iron lung, because that's what Western medicine did. It put you in this machine, and it doesn't work. It didn't work on anyone. And my mother's mother took me out of the iron lung and healed me. She was a midwife and a shaman, herbalist, and she knew that I needed to be massaged and that I needed to have water therapy. The physicians thought it was quackery, but she was right, and they were wrong. So I know shamanism works.
Wow. What did the doctor say when you were healed?
Well, it turned out there was a whole movement. Women nurses and midwives were confronting the medical profession and saying, what you're doing, those horrible things you put people in, don't work. And they said, oh, well, it does work, you'll see. Well, now they don't even want to talk about it, the fact that they failed to heal. And that the nurses and midwives healed. So I walk as a result of that. And I know people who had polio like me, and it was my whole left side that was paralyzed. And those people still don't walk. They have iron leg braces. And it's because the doctors were wrong.
Frank always talks about how his whole experience growing up from the time he was born was fighting the model of modern
Western medicine.
That when he was first born, they told his mom and dad that he was mentally retarded and they should just put him in an institution. No intelligence, they said. Wow. He has no intelligence. And his mom said, you know, I look at him, I look in his eyes and I don't see that.
Right.
But he said it wasn't a one-time battle, it was constant because they were always coming at her and them to try to get him to get these operations or just whatever the shtick was that they were doing.
The fad at the time.
Right, right.
Yeah, they don't admit that Western medicine goes through fads
right.
and it changes. They don't admit it.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, no one is now being put in an iron lung for polio. There are people who have polio. But it's not being used. That means it failed.
Right. K kept saying S seeing kids who got the treatments, the various treatments and operations that they were trying to talk Frank into.
Yeah.
And he said after the treatments and operations they were way worse off than they had been before.
Exactly.
S so why should you do it?
Why do it? Right. Exactly. Does he talk to young people? Do you talk to young people about resisting?
Yeah, I think, well, we were constantly talking to whoever is in earshot about it. So right. I think that includes young people. Yeah. W. R. Wrote A. P. O. A poem when I got is this tortures? No, when I got I N invited to a med at UC Berkeley. He was invited to speak with a group of med students. You want to read the poem, right? Yeah. Well, get our binder out that Erica just recently alphabetized.
Uh-huh.
Says, do we remember what the poem's called? Okay.
Mutation is evolution.
No, is that short guy? I'll find it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that all poetry?
This is it's mostly poetry, but it's all of Frank's writings.
Wow. You've got it in plastic too.
Yeah.
Keep it.
Yeah. Any guesses on what it might be called, Frank? Not a clue. Okay. No cannots. Yay,
no
Mikey.
Cannot.
Somebody. There's always one of us that remembers. Okay. No cannots. Should I read it? Okay, would you grab me my glasses, which are right there? Yeah. Okay, so this was written on April 28th, 2002. No cannots. Talking to future healers and teachers, and maybe future muckrakers and troublemakers. Well, not really future, because hopefully you are doing it right now. Hopefully I'm not talking to the future guards of the corporate normalcy, armed with cannots, limiting futures from birth, enforcing coloring only within the lines, enforcing doing everything the right way, the normal way.
Wow, that's lovely.
Yeah.
That's important.
Like your G-R-A grandmother.
Mother.
Like your grandmother, G-O got S shit B because she H because she E no H E
helped
W H I T white she helped white people.
Yes, as well as indigenous people. Mm. Huh. In other words, she broke the rules.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. Mm. Exactly. You break the rules and you get in trouble. But that's why she was such a good shaman and healer.
Mm. Exactly.
Exactly. Right. She lived outside the normal boundaries. And that's where you get the power to heal. You don't get it by being inside a box. Right?
Why did the TRI tribe not U N D understand that
because of oppression, indigenous people feel oppressed and they feel that people who are not indigenous don't understand and that they shouldn't be healed and that they won't believe. That they'll be laughed at. And my grandmother never believed that. She believed that she could heal anyone. But many, many indigenous healers feel that it's only other people within their own culture. We both ran into this at Zuni Pueblo and other places where they feel that if they share the medicine with somebody who's not Zuni, they're going to laugh at them or it's not going to work. They're frightened. And so then they are mean to those indigenous people who will share with other people. And it's their own fear, I think.
L. It is always a R. I. A risk to B L A laughed at?
Yes. It is. You have to be strong.
Why? Do? Why? Were? Your? Why was your grandmother? A. H. Healer?
Because her mother and father were both healers, and because she had the ability. It's a gift to be able to heal. And she had the ability, and she used it all of her life. And she did it without being paid very often. She would stay up all night.
S-H-A, shaman.
Yes.
Is not a money maker, is not a C-A, career.
Career.
Shamanism is not a career move.
It's not a smart career move, right? It's a calling. It's something you have to do.
Yes. In your book, in your B-O-D, it's in your body.
It's in your it's in your mind, your heart, your body.
But you did not want to be a shaman.
No. I was frightened. I ran away.
Like your mother.
Right, but I wasn't angry. My mother disrespected it. I respected it, but I was frightened of it for a long time.
Why? Frightened?
The responsibility. I knew that if I went down that path, I would have to do it all my life.
T-R-A. Trapped.
Trapped.
In. R-E. Responsibility.
Right. Exactly. Right?
S. So. You. T. R. Tried. To. A. Avoid.
Avoid. Right. But it, you can't. It gets you.
How? How does
How
it get
does
you?
How does it get you?
Yeah.
People recognize something in you, other people do, and they don't let you go. They recognize. Dennis and I were together in Guatemala and he was translating the Mayan sacred book, the Popol Vuh. I was writing ethnography to get a PhD, and they studied us. And they decided that we had to be trained.
Oops.
Trapped.
F. E. E. Feet don't fail me now.
Right. Yep. So what happens is other shamans recognize you. They just, you hide, you don't do it, and they recognize. When we were in Mongolia, these Mongolian shamans, we didn't tell them that we were trained. They recognized us, and they said, well, you know something about this. You've been trained. And when Dennis and I went, what? So you can't hide.
L-O-V-E. you, Louise. She's a woman that was in the early 70s, late 60s, mm-hmm. When Frank was in San Bernardino mm-hmm. and going to school there and still living mm-hmm. with his mother and trying to get out of mm-hmm. the house. He didn't want to be the crippled kid who lived with his mother his mm-hmm. whole life, yeah. unsuccessfully getting out at that point. But Louise was kind of the older hippie woman that had this property uh-huh. that some of the college kids mm-hmm. would hang out at. She had like a pool and mm-hmm. it was just like where wow. people would hang out. And Frank had not talked to her directly, but she would mm. see him there. Because a lot of times she wasn't even there. People would just hang out there if she was out of town. Uh-huh. It was a UNO unofficial COM community, commune, an unofficial commune.
Right.
But at one point she had said one time to Frank that she was watching him when a bunch of people were sitting around, and she said, "I could see that yes. you mm. saw something that nobody else saw."
Exactly.
And yeah.
That's how you're recognized.
Yeah. Yeah. She told you. That's right. Yeah. I forgot that part of the story. Because at that point, Frank is a college kid. He just wants to get the girl and get out of the house with mom. That's the extent of his aspirations. A. V. I. R. G. I.
Virgin.
And he was a virgin at this point.
Uh-huh.
And she starts telling him, you know, you have to start using your body rather than seeing it as a liability. And she told him he was a shaman. And he's just like, shaman? Yeah, well, will I get the girl? Does that mean I'll get the girl? And she said, you listen to me. You know, you start, you know, you'll see. And she kind of outlined what turned out to be our lives. And she came back here. You know, years into it, she said, "This is it. This is what I was telling
How
you."
How did you guys meet?
How did we meet? I'd been living in Berkeley a year. This was in '75, and Frank had just mm-hmm. recently moved to Berkeley. And okay. I had finished college in Pennsylvania. I lived in Philadelphia, I always knew I wasn't going to get married and have kids and do all that. But I was pretty isolated. I didn't know anything about anything. But in college, a woman came up to me in the bookstore. It was my last semester, and I had a free thing that I was just looking at the books, you know, to see. And there was this book about like psychology and dreams, or called to me. And so I took the class just for that. And it was a guy that came from Berkeley to teach the class.
Neat.
And this woman that was in the class, this very kind of exotic-looking woman, came up to me shortly at the beginning of the class and said, "We're doing a meditation group based on Uspensky," which I never read. I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I really didn't know anything, you know.
Right.
And I think you'd be good. And I said, okay, cool. Yeah. And that was really the beginning of it for
beginning.
Me. Because I did that, meditation thing, and then another woman came out and did a Fisher-Hoffman process, which was just like this 10-week intensive that had a lot of mind trip stuff, which introduced me to, just kind of seeing visual, like having that kind of thing in my body. And then she said, "You should move to Berkeley." And I had no money. I had nothing. You know, I came out to Berkeley and to train to do Fisher-Hoffman, because that was the only thing, you know, that I knew to do. And I quickly was very turned off by it, because it was like the new age growth movement thing, and nobody seemed genuine.
Human potential.
It was like I just couldn't relate at all. So I thought, okay. I'm going to get a real job with regular people, and I'll just be with regular people.
Real regular people.
And I had this very vague sense of what alternative there was at that point. It had to do with community. I knew that.
Mm.
And it really was very unformed. And I worked at this travel agency for less than a year, and then Frank wheels in. Oh, so I got, my real job was a travel agent.
Travel agent. And then, but your love was something different.
Well, I didn't even know, you know. Yeah. I was just waiting. I knew I was waiting. I stopped doing everything that didn't work. No more boyfriends, no more this, no more that. Mm-hmm. Everything that didn't work, I wasn't going to do. So I was just kind of hanging out, waiting, you know. And then Frank wheels in his motor chair. And I had, like, you know, this with no bra, and I had to lean over the counter to read his board, and he saw down my shirt. And he said, "You'd be great in this play I'm doing." And when he wheeled in, I had never seen anybody that looked like Frank, and I'm thinking, oh, God, I hope he doesn't come up to me. He wheels right up to me.
He goes right to you.
Right to me. But the second we had eye contact, I just knew. I knew at that point.
Wow.
I said, this is it.
This
you know.
Is it.
And if I don't go with this, I'm full of shit. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that. And so... So, and then there's the play, you know, and there was no play. He just made that up. He said he was willing to create a play, but he didn't need to.
He didn't need to. Right. If you needed to have a play,
right.
he wouldn't
make
done
a
it,
play.
Right? But you didn't need
no.
it anymore.
But he said, if you give me your phone number, I'll have my wife call you. I thought, wife, this is safe. He's got a wife, you know.
How interesting.
And
what a clever guy.
He did. He was in a four-way. There were four people in the marriage, and they had two kids.
Uh-huh.
And so his wife did call me.
And
I went over. They had this little two-bedroom apartment, and one of the rooms was Frank's studio where he painted and met with people. And he gave me his binder with his writing.
Mm-hmm. So
I was doing a workshop that I STA started in Santa Fe. And did it in New York City. And T.R. tried to do it in San Bernardino because Louise gave him her land to live on. And so he had this incredible spread, but he couldn't find people in San Bernardino that
who
wanted to do the work.
Even today, I don't think you would.
Right, right. So I... D.R. drove to Esalen.
Esalen,
To T. try to get them to L. E. let me. Do a workshop
do a
there.
Workshop there. Huh.
They said, go to Berkeley. So, Frank moved to Berkeley. He moved to Berkeley, and that's when I met you shortly after that. But the W, the woman, the W.O., the work shop. Wasn't taking off, and that's when we hooked up. Well, I read Frank's writings, and I was like, "That was it." I just realized he's figured it all out. You know, this is I don't need to figure it out. This is it. And so that I quit my job shortly after that, and we started hanging out. Frank would show up and pick me up at lunch. And my boss loved him. And so as soon as she'd see Frank, she'd go, 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 go. And one time when we were walking toward lunch, was really just a couple weeks into it, I said, boy, it's so much more fun hanging out with you than working. And he said, well, you know, you don't have to work. And I said, oh, really? I said, okay, 1 minute. And I went back. And I said, I'd rather hang out with Frank, so I'm going to quit now. And that was like...
That was it.
That was it. And so...
Wonderful.
We kind of came up with... Frank said we could take the Fisher Hoffman thing, which was more trendy, and infuse it with the work that Frank was doing and see if that we
go
could
on
get
the road with it, right?
Well, just try to get people in Berkeley, B, E, because Frank had a free space. I was always, I was after C, community.
Right. It's the best medicine.
S. So. I. V. H. A. I had. P. E. People. Do. The. Workshop. But they were not L I living it. So after their commitment ended for the workshop, they were just leave.
Was it?
I wanted more. So we didn't get much response to our workshop flyer after we came up with this, but we did get this one guy who we would meet with people if they responded, and he met with us for hours. I would like read Frank's board, and
really?
He was a psychic teacher. And he had a lot of students. And at some point in the interview, he said, you know, Frank, I'm not interested in your workshop, but I wonder if you'd be willing to meet with me like this every week and I'd just pay you. So Frank said, no problem.
A consultation.
Right. Mm-hmm. But then he would go to his psychic class and say he had a new teacher. And then, of course, everybody wanted to go to their teacher's teacher.
Right.
So all of a sudden, we had two full workshops a week going, and all these people were meeting individually with Frank. Uh-huh. And at some point, we shifted into relationship counseling, because he said he's flexible. He'll do whatever works. And built community out of that period. Whatever. L. A, B, whatever label they want. Yeah. The work is the same.
The labels change.
Yeah. S. So, why did not you R U run?
I don't understand.
At the point of run from being
why did
a
I
shaman,
run?
Why didn't you run?
Oh, because I was trapped. I realized, you know, that I had to do it. I had been healed by a shaman. And, I mean, to not be trained and to help others, it's wrong. You know? And I was mature enough to realize that.
And your grandmother was N.A. G, nagging you on, nagging you in your dreams?
Yes. I knew I had to do it. How did you know that? Because you're a shaman.
I did my homework.
Ah, yes, you did. Right. Yeah, she kept coming to me in dreams, you know, and telling me that I had to do this.
She was D E A dead,
yes.
But when did that M A matter?
When did that matter? Yeah, it doesn't matter at all. In fact, when you're in your spiritual state, you're more powerful. And she was really able to convince me that I had to do this, which I did, and I'm very grateful, you know, that I did it. Something my mother never understood or really forgave. She never accepted it.
You know, about you?
About me, yeah. Or about her own mother, too. She was embarrassed. She was ashamed.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because it wasn't bourgeois. Mm. And my mother wanted so to be bourgeois. Mm-hmm. And she was ashamed of her own mother because her own mother was very rural, very folksy, and a wonderful healer and midwife. And she was embarrassed by her mother. I loved my grandmother, and my mother didn't want me to be connected to her. She wanted me to be like her.
Even after you were healed?
Mm-hmm. Well, my parents couldn't believe that such an ignorant person as my mother's mother could heal me. They really had trouble with that concept because they believed in Western medicine and the doctors, you know. And I was in the Walter Reed Hospital, a big fancy medical hospital, and they just trusted. They totally believed. And actually, it was my father who stopped believing quicker than my mother and said, okay, you know, let her go ahead and see if she can do anything for this kid, you know, because she's just going to be a cripple all her life, which my parents didn't like the idea of having a child who was a cripple.
Oh, wow. Wow,
yeah. Yeah, they didn't. I was an only child, so so what happened? They got a girl, and they got a cripple. So you can see that they were disappointed.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was lucky. Well, because of your mom, his dad was military. He was an Air Force kid. Frank was an Air Force kid.
Oh.
But his mom was the one that connected with Frank.
Oh, really?
And nice. Fought, you know, kind
for
of
him.
Yeah, fought for Frank and fought
That's
for
good.
Not going into the
right.
model that was being pushed on them.
Well, it was lucky my grandmother fought for me and said, get that kid out of that iron lung, basically. You're not doing her any good, you know. And she kept saying she's going to be crippled all her life if she stays in there.
Yes.
And they were right. I mean, she was absolutely right that I would be.
So after she healed you, what did your parents say then?
Well, they were pleased that I was healed, but, you know.
M. O. D. E. Modern medicine. S. A. Said. S. A. Say. Says 30% R H healed be by them, by they, don't know what. Oh, oh my.
It's true. They don't know why people heal. Wow.
S, but they, S, but they, D, I, S, C, O, discount that.
Right. They call it the placebo effect, the placebo effect, which is the doctor who resides within, really, is the better way to think of it. But there is self-healing as possible. You know, but when they don't understand it, they just say, oh, well, it's all in the head. But, you know, they're changing. They're beginning to accept prayer. People who go into and have operations, have things done, who believe, or have friends who believe and pray for them, they've now statistically demonstrated do better than people who don't believe in anything. So they're opening up a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit, you know. And there's now this integrative medicine that's being taught. There's 27 universities, medical schools that teach alternative, complementary, and integrative medicine. And that's what we're talking about here, in the sense it's shamanic healing, spiritual healing, hands-on healing, herbalism. In other words, they're being trained in the old ways in 27 major hospitals today, as well as Western medicine. You know, they're putting it all together.
A R O U around 1910 M O D modern medicine H no W E N went for A M O N O monopoly.
Yes, about 1910. Yeah. Right. And it was a way to make money. It wasn't about healing people.
You can not make money, is that it? Yes. On M-I-D midwifery H-E-R herbalism E, etc.
You can survive, but right. You don't get rich.
Right.
And doctors want to get rich. It's a profession of people who want to be rich. Still.
Yeah. S. So. They. D. R. O. Drove their competition
out. Yes, they did. That's how you get rich. You conquer your competition instead of cooperating with them.
And wasn't that a point before that the other alternative things were very alive?
They were very alive, and there were different medical models, different ideas. But they got together and created a monopoly business to get rich. It's all about money, and not about healing.
And it still goes on.
Yes.
All over the world, when Western medicine sends people into the field, when we were in Mongolia, we met a British physician whose really terrific with a rare disorder mm-hmm. that occurs during childbirth. And he was sure that he was arriving in Mongolia to combat hundreds of superstitious, ignorant midwives.
You know, he told us
he was going to save the Mongolians from all these female
these ignorant women.
Yeah. Oh, my.
And Dennis and I were horrified. And he really believed that he was there. It was...
Wow.
But he had a technique, a very unusual technique for a difficult birth that does work, but it's very rare. Most births work rather easily.
Yes. Al, Louise mm-hmm. was a midwife uh-huh. back when it before it was
before.
Legal to be a midwife.
I know.
She didn't want to be a midwife. It was one of those things where people kept calling her and asking if they would come and you know. She said at some point she got a medical book out of the library and read up on it because she just surrendered to the fact that
she had to do it.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of places where it's not legal. It's not yet legal everywhere in the United States to be a midwife.
Wow.
It's pretty shocking. Like the state of New York. There's only certain areas in the state where you can practice midwifery. Otherwise, you can go to jail.
Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not like... I don't know how is California? Who knows?
Well, I think it's legal here, isn't it?
Everywhere, maybe.
Yeah. It's legal around here, right?
Right.
Yeah. When my two kids were born in New York City, they would not let Frank into the room when
they were born.
Is that what you mean? Mm. Yeah, right. On the floor. They wouldn't even let him on the floor.
Right.
So they called Louise, and Louise flew out to do it, to birth the kids.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? What? R. S. M. A. Small T E A C H
teaching. What are
small teaching?
What small teaching?
Yes.
From shamanism is
yes. You wrote the S H A M shaman T A T A U
taught
shamans taught you in no taught you to be by small teachings.
Well, they had us share our dreams, and then they shared their dreams with us, and then they showed us how to dream together with them and to learn through dreaming. That's one of the things that they did. And they taught us that our bodies are alive, and that the right side of both of our bodies is male, the left side of both of our bodies is female, and that the entire body is has lightning in it, koyopa, it means sheet lightning. And so we're completely alive, and that our bodies can tell us things about the world. So we were taught a kind of shamanism. I talk about it as embodied shamanism, that our bodies think, they teach us things, okay? Whereas many shamans are taught to go out of their body and travel on a long journey, we were taught to bring things in. into our bodies?
Me? Mm. Me too?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. Some people are frightened of that. Mm. They say it's possession, but I call it embodiment. Mm.
After all, the E-A-R, Earth, after all, the Earth is one body.
It is. And it's with us. We are part of the Earth.
E. X. Exactly. Mm.
Exactly. Right. So that was the greatest gift, was for us, wouldn't you say, Dennis?
Yes.
To have our bodies come alive, you know. Mm. And that's a teaching from other systems, too, about the energy in the body, qi or chi, you know, Chinese oriental systems. Mm. In the Mayan system, the notion that you're connected to the meteorological world, to lightning, along the horizon, and to realize that knowledge comes to you and it goes into your body, and you learn to think with your body.
Yes. I see a call it chirotic. Frank made up the word chirotic.
Chirotic.
It's C-H-I-E. Well, it's chirotic, but it's from chi and erotic.
Chirotic. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
To put it together. Yeah.
Right. Well, so chiro is the energy.
The energy. The force. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what it is, because it is extremely erotic. I mean, it is a live, sensual, sexual body. You know, that shamans work with.
Yes.
Right.
When people H E A hear F E M I feminine. When people hear feminine, they think G E N gender.
Right.
It is not H gender. We all have both
genders. Right. We all participate in both. Yes. And that's very important. You know.
I think M O most S shamans you use F E female feminine.
I think they do. Feminine energies and knowledge. Right? Whether they are male or female.
Yes. The B O body is J is J. The body is A M E D medium.
Yeah, it's a communication system.
I am L, U, I'm lucky. You always say you're lucky to be in the body that you're in. Is that what you mean? Yeah. Yeah. Because? Well, let's see. You usually say that in relation to
knowledge,
being a performance artist, but I think you mean it just because it's that it's not normal. So it kind of, people, it's easier to not fall into the normal kinds of interactions with people and
it,
frames.
It can be special.
Or the same, or the same connection to the whole world, other people, but also just and what
be with
messages you would receive from outside would be different,
right?
And B R E A break O. Other, P, people,
break open,
L, I, limits, breaks, and it breaks
open
other people's
limits. Right. Right. It gives you a special way of being in the world, and it affects other people. Right.
Yes. What should I ask you?
Oh, what should I ask you? That's unusual for an interviewer to ask.
H, hey, I am
unusual.
A shaman.
Yes, exactly. It's a good shaman's question. What should I ask you? Yeah. You should ask me, why did you write that book? Maybe you think that's a stupid question.
Why did you
okay.
write that book.
Right.
And what book is that?
Yes, okay. It's called The Woman in the Shaman's Body. Okay. And I wrote the book for two motivations, love and anger. People often write books either for love or anger, and I wrote it for both reasons. And my anger was against Mircea Eliade, who's supposed to be the world expert on shamanism.
Never heard of him.
Good, I'm glad you haven't. There's a book called Shamanism, which is supposed to be the book. And he wrote it. And he never met a living shaman in his entire life.
No.
He was a novelist. And you can't get an advance, you can't get money in advance as on a novel. You have to write the whole novel. So he was in a hard place, and he decided he had to write nonfiction to get an advance. And he wrote a pot boiler, is what it's called. And it's shamanism. He researched it quick and dirty. It's not good work, but it's considered the book in the field.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so I wrote against a particular book. I mean,
when did that book come out?
A long time ago. I think it was first out in French in 1951. Then it was translated into English in 1964. It's still considered the must book.
Wow.
When I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, I read it. It was really cool to read it in the 60s. We all read the book. And I slowly realized that he didn't know what he was talking about. That was my anger. Then the love was the love of my grandmother for healing me, the love of Essie Parrish, a very famous Pomo shaman from Northern California who I knew, who was a fabulous healer, and to realize that women have always been shamans, and that the feminine is part of shamanism, even though Eliade did the following thing. He described about 300 shamans in the book. 6 were women, supposedly. Well, I went back to his sources. He did sex operation changes. It would be a woman's case that he would read in the source, and he would say he. And then the few women he described, he said they were either not real shamans, or they weren't as good as the men shamans, or they only shamanized with difficulty. I mean, it was really, or they were sorceresses, or they were witches.
No.
So he denigrated the 6 women he did describe. He did sex operations on the other. I just got, so that's my anger part. Because when you do something that dishonest, you know, you need to be called on it. Nobody had ever called him on it. You know, so that's my anger part. And then my love part is knowing these women healers and having been healed by a woman healer. So I put together my discomfort with the wrong story with my knowledge about women shamans. That's how I wrote the book. So it was a combination of love and anger.
And even M-A-L male shamans are F-E feminine?
Yes. And female shamans can be masculine. And they gender shift. They go in and out, just like shape-shifting between animals, birds, bears, and humans. They gender shift. They move between these categories.
And I do. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's a power place that shamans work from, is that ability to move between worlds. In all kinds of worlds, getting out of boxes.
Yes. And F R A fragmentation. Getting out of
fragmentation.
Defragmenting things.
Right. Creating a new holism. Right. You're right. Yep. So that's why I wrote the book.
I-N-T-E-R interviewing a G, you, a guy, about A, L, alternative, E, alternative energy. He was the G, the guy who W wrote the C L I M climate change treaty for the UN. He said S-T started talking about Mikey. Mikey's better at this story. He started talking about Alden Bryant when Frank was interviewing him, and he was talking about the...
Well, the energy sources that they've already discovered that... Basically, it's energy that's available. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the names of it, but it's there, and it's just infinitely powerful.
An infinitely available.
An infinitely available for free. Hmm. And they found ways to actually tap it.
And so when he started talking about that, Frank said, I talk about Chero, and I wonder if it's the same thing you're talking about. And we talked about it a minute ago. He goes, yeah, that's exactly
the
what
body
I'm talking
energy.
About.
The energy of the universe.
Yes.
Is this guy a physicist?
The guy that he was talking about is a physicist that he wrote about. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Adam Trombley
was the one who was actually disenfranchised from the scientific community.
He's the one who talks about vacuums, right?
As well.
I just a student just told me about that.
Right.
Showed me that book. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's ahead of his time.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what happens if you're ahead of your time.
And the P E N A Pentagon. B O bought him S so he can not R.T. talk about it.
Wow. At this point?
Right. He's not allowed to talk about it. Although we actually had, we have a piece that he wrote about it that we have up on our website.
Uh-huh. Before they closed him down.
Well, no, it's, we got this, he's not allowed to talk about it, but Alden Bryant's thing is, well, he's not allowed to talk about it, but I'm talking about it. So that's one of the things he does is he goes around and talks about it and gives it to people like us who are willing to put it out.
How interesting.
Yeah.
So that he's not communicating it, you are.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good solution.
Good plan.
That's a good solution. Yeah.
S. So. S. H. Shaman. Could be using that energy that he's talking about.
It's an
about.
Energy source, right?
Yes.
And they are. Yes. And you can feel the if you're in a room with many shamans, as we were in Mongolia, you can feel the energy in that room. It is unbelievable. I mean, it radiates because they have space around them that's full of energy.
Yes. I T talk about I N T E R interpenetration. Interpenetration. We are in each other's bodies. Are I right now? B. E, because the B, O, the body, G, goes out beyond the skin.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
R. W-O-W-I-R-W-I-T, witches? Are witches shamans?
Yes. The word for witch, it's witan, W-I-T-A-N. It means the one who knows. The word shaman, Shaman means the one who knows. It's the same tradition. And the witches were persecuted, and that was the European shamanic line. And just as the shamans were persecuted as well. But yes, they are, it's a form of shamanism.
E. R. I. Erica is director of enrichment at a retirement community. Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah.
And R. E. A. Really? She. It. Is. S. H. Shaman. What she's, the work she's doing is shamanism.
Yeah, I could really feel that in the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah. Talk about, do you want to talk about that?
How I'd
you,
like to hear that.
Yeah.
I don't know, I could just feel it in my body, like just, not that I didn't know, but just like, I don't know. Not that I didn't, I don't know. Because in a way, I just, it's just date, it's just life. It's just, you know, which it is too. There is a separation. But the core of what I do is I lead groups in assisted living, which are, you know, more people in wheelchairs. And we meet several times a week, and it's kind of a core group, and it's like going into the cave. And it's just very playful and warm and cozy, and I've just followed kind of what works. And more, it's just a lot of movement, following each other's movements, and a lot of sounds. Making weird sounds, you know. We're in the hallway and we're going yippee, and just feeling how just making these, I mean, we do sing some songs that they like as well. I integrate like the songs with the movement.
That's good.
But the but the sound stuff too, and the movement, and following each other, and it energy just shifts.
Are some of them elderly people as well?
They're all elderly people.
Oh, they're all elderly.
And most of them are like in their 90s.
Wow.
A lot of them are in their 90s. They're sharp, but they're... And everybody loves to come. I mean, it's built up over the year, so where at first it was like, oh, this is silly, this is kid stupid. And now some of those people are the first ones to zip on in there before the chairs are set up. And
interesting.
And you know, they love to come.
And you were saying part of what you like about the assisted living people is they're more willing to kind of go into I don't know, what would you say, not normal places?
Yeah, non-linear kind of. We work a lot with imagination, too. Sometimes we go on journeys. I say, are we going? I say, how are we going to get there? We're going to fly. So we're flying. Where are we going? You know, we'll end up in paradise, or we go to the moon an awful lot.
Wow.
Take your clothes off.
They take. What are we wearing in paradise?
Nothing.
You know, often do this, pull out this suitcase or this trunk, and I start pulling imaginary, but they're all, nobody's like, sometimes I'll remind in your imagination, but most people just totally get it, you know. Pulling things out of the trunk, what's here? And then another thing I do is I'm like, where's your magic today? And they're like, it's in my foot. Whoa. Or it's in my... I say, what color is it? Purple. You know, they'll you know... And
that's
then I'll
a
just,
big color.
And then I'll just say, you know, pull your magic out and hold it in your hand. Stretch it out. Everybody's doing it, you know. Pull
that's
it up,
great.
Push it over your head. Energy totally shifts. And then I'm like... Throw it across the room. Throw it at somebody else. And they're just like, they're
they
totally
do it. That's great. And it makes you happy, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's no.
a job that's not a job.
It's fun. It's
no.
Fun.
G. O. Goal. It's not goal-oriented.
No goals.
Or work.
No.
Yeah.
It's play.
Right. It's play.
It's play. And play is a good way to live.
Yes.
Right.
They are not dying.
Yeah, nobody's dying.
They're noticing that people aren't dying since Erica started doing the groups. Because they'll have
because they want to come back. They want to play.
Certain family members aren't complaining very much anymore about
things. How interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Are you keeping like a notebook on this? Or are you training someone else to do it as well?
Well, I just got a new assistant, and it's not like and so it's sort of in an unofficial, I mean, I don't like say do the group the way I do it, but she comes to a lot of them and watches me, and that's how we picked the assistant, because we went through the interviewing process, and I'd have people come to the group. That's really how I could tell. And some people would just be like, they, you know, just get all stiff, or they would be like, oh, you're, you know, they, just the way they, I'd say, you know, so how was that for you? You could just tell in their body whether they would just jump in and participate or think it was
strange.
Right. And so the person I picked thought it was really a lot of fun. And so she's I have her come to the groups when we're both there. And then the first group she led on her own. I didn't say do it this you know,
way.
I was like, well, you want to do art? Do an art project. You know, we also did that, whatever she wants to do. She like brought music and did something similar, whatever. So
even if you didn't try to write a long prose narrative description of what you're doing, you should start keeping a notebook.
You write down the poems.
We write poems,
you write the
too.
Poems.
We
okay.
wrote we
those are
we,
condensed experiences.
Yeah,
right?
Those are group poems. They're group poems.
Great.
So we write them in the group
together,
and then I read it out loud, and we've got maybe 50 of them.
Wow.
And we're pretty soon we'll have the time to put a magazine together of them.
Oh, that would be good.
So those are documented. Probably video would be the way to
document.
Did you
ever happen to see a documentary called Number Our Days, or the book that has that same title, Number Our Days? It's by a woman who, Barbara Meyerhoff, an anthropologist who began to go to these old folks' homes for Jewish people because she was thinking of herself aging, and she would wear big shoes and clump around, you know, shoes that were much too big for her, thinking about what it would be like to have trouble walking. And she did this wonderful book. Then she, of course, dies of cancer young. She never gets to be an old Jewess, as she said. But the Number Our Days book, it's so poignant because it really shows, she creates what she calls nonce rituals, N-O-N-C-E, one-time only rituals, things that only happen once. And she gets this whole elder hostel of Jewish people together, and they're playing. It's similar. And they're just having a wonderful time. You know. But the sad thing is that then she dies very young. You know, so Barbara didn't get old the way these folks did herself, you know. But that's what I kept thinking of, was that number. You saw the film, right, and the book. Because there's not enough models like that. We treat elderly people or people with difficulties as though they're odd, you know.
Yes.
We don't share, we don't learn, you know.
Yeah, I did. When I was in graduate school, I worked with people with Alzheimer's. That's where your training is. I mean, I've been working with older people for a long time, but when I started leading groups for, it was with people with Alzheimer's.
And did you find them to be playful?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean, they taught me.
Interesting.
They taught me, because I was very shy, and leading a group was terrifying, but for whatever reason, I'd set it up for myself to push through that limit with the help of working with Frank, because I was kind of stuck right before that point and really quite afraid to leap into that. It was great. They were just wonderful. I mean, I felt very safe with them, I think, and and just my own playfulness just came out, and it has come out more and more since.
They must get into some interesting spaces. You know, it's all constructed as more and more as being subtracted.
You know, but it must...
As if there might not be some benefits somewhere along the way.
E, Erica, S, T, A, started with W, E, A, wearing sexy clothes to work.
Interesting.
And the residents, well, actually the residents and the staff, everybody was encouraging about that because they would get excited.
Interesting.
Yeah. How? How did you get T-R-A trapped? Trapped? W I with me?
Well, I had been doing a lot of performance for a long time, and I was also very interested in shamanism. Like, and I did a lot of reading. I looked at that book and it very boring.
It is very boring.
And so I would try to read things, and I was never satisfied. You know, I was really trying to figure out, wanting to know, like, what the link was between performance and shamanism. That's where, you know. But I was also doing on a journey of healing as well, and also really wanting to figure out, to know about intimacy and relationship. So it was all kind of all of that swirling together. But when I was in graduate school, it was psychology and drama therapy
together.
But and the drama therapy was good, but the psychology was really quite heavy for me, and it was challenging. So when I hit the point of having to start leading the groups, I kind of hit a wall and was really putting out a lot of energy to wanting a mentor. And in 1 year, three showed up in a row, and kind of sort of like one led
to another,
but they all saw me in some way, I think, was saw something. And
Frank was one of them.
I saw a flyer in Berkeley.
For a workshop.
I was getting ready to do a performance, thesis performance in grad school.
There didn't end up being a workshop because Erica was the only one that replied to the flyer.
So
this is a familiar story.
Right.
And so we met, and that was it. Like, I kept coming back.
Why? Why were you trapped at that point? And why did you keep coming back? B. E, because, N, U, nudity, what, and eroticism were difficult points.
Were challenging. It wasn't something I was actively seeking out. So I was very shy in the beginning and wouldn't do anything. It was a feeling. It was a feeling. That's why I stayed. Kept coming back. And then, because things changed. I changed. Life changed. I was looking for some real change, like something that really worked. And I certainly wasn't finding that in psychology. I wanted transformation, and it was concrete, and people noticed in my life. And
interesting.
That, you know, that was, besides the feeling and the intimacy. But I think I denied parts of that for a while, but it was the feeling. It was the feeling of coming home, of being seen.
You is that C O M M O common?
I don't know. Anna, did you study shamanism formally at all, or just what you...
The type of shamanism I was doing probably up till that point was journeying outside of the body. And I learned how to do that when I was about 17 or 18. And took to that on some level for many years, did a lot of that, and took some workshops, but mostly just started doing it, and probably did a little bit of reading, but I felt like I was out of my body a lot, so my task was to get back
into
in my
body,
and learn how to be
here. Were you involved in drumming and all of that, and and traveling?
Yeah, that was easy for me to do. Getting back in the body was
harder.
Out of your body, do you mean like out in the way one is in a dream? Or there's another kind where one could be 10, 15 feet out, like
of your body.
Right over there?
And looking at yourself from over there.
I've had those experiences, but the journeying was like a dream, you know,
or active imagination,
consciously with an intention journeying outside of the body. But I think certain experiences in my childhood, I think that's common. Like you just kind of check out. That's pretty normal. I mean, certain experiences in my childhood made that happen, but I think that's pretty common. Like, people just kind of check out and you're half here and
half somewhere
else rather than just really being here.
W H I, which is K I N kind of. D A dangerous.
Dangerous to check out, yes. Right. Just go flying around.
You can, you may not find your way back.
Yes, that is possible. There are people who don't find their way back. You know. And that's why Sandra Ingerman teaches soul retrieval and various things. There's people who leave their bodies and they can't find themselves anymore.
That was one of the first E N C encounters I had. I was L I living in a commune of 300 people.
Wow.
When, where it was a D F A a fad to channel. Everybody was channeling spirit.
Oh, interesting.
And I, H, A, had to T, A, talk, A, F, a few people down.
Ah. Right. I can imagine that. Yeah.
That then S P R I spirit S spirits
spirits
S T started C L A I claiming to be me.
Oh, that's scary.
And F L A T flattering.
Oh, flattering.
Flattering me.
The ego's always there, right?
T H E these were in other people. Oh, the spirits would come through other people saying that they were Frank.
That they were Frank, wow.
And they were flattering Frank. But when I said, no, it ain't me, Frank said, that ain't
that,
me.
That ain't me. Wow.
They, T, you, turned, they turned.
Wow.
So, P, E, people were not L, I, listening to you. Frank was trying to, he was mainly trying to get everybody back to Earth and being with each other, but nobody was listening to him until he started channeling a spirit who told them the same thing that he was telling them.
Interesting.
And then once the spirit said it, everybody
it
listened.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
He really is a shaman. He knows how to do this stuff. He's got all the tricks. Yes. Wow. This is great.
So then he would have been in more than one place at once.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Exactly.
The multiple realities that you can inherit.
I am not S, you, sure? I'm not sure. If I am a made it up. Oh, the channeling. It was the spirit was called Reed.
Reed?
Right, R-E-E-D. He said, he's always said, I'm not sure if I made all that up or if it really was a spirit, but it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't in the end.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah, well, if you made it up, that's fine too. It exists. I mean, these things we make up exist.
A. P. U. P. P. E. Puppet. Reed was like a puppet.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Might have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, H, A, I had to T Y type. Right, because he would type it. That Reed would come through. So Frank would sit at an old typewriter. This is pre-computers. And he'd type each thing. So everybody would be waiting for the latest installment of Reed.
Wow. I bet that was incredible. Yeah. This is some years ago. Right?
This was in the early 70s.
Early 70s. Yeah. Such a golden time.
Yeah.
How tall was Reed, or what?
What did Reed look like?
He was in his L.A. last L, in his last life, A.E.N. English B. Bookseller.
Huh. Interesting. The English bookseller.
Who went to Russia to study with a S P I spiritual G spiritual guide.
A spiritual guide. Uh-huh.
But that was to I N T E intellectual.
Too intellectual.
But the stuff, the stuff holds up. We've published it, a book called The Art of Living. Because it really holds up. He would speak directly to the various people that Frank was trying to address. But the things that he talked about, are pretty universal and can be applied. Yeah.
It helped people.
It helped people, yeah.
That's great. Sounds like good pedagogy.
And he, D, E, S, C, described what we are doing now. He described our life now, back at that point.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Because that's 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So. Great. Yeah.
It's time.
Just about. Yeah.
He's ready to hold up up his number.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we didn't eat dinner yet.
So you're ready. Yeah. Okay. S. So.
So.
They can get your book everywhere.
It's best if you go onto my website and find it there, because I was just at Cody's today and they didn't have it.
Were you expecting them to have it?
Oh, yeah. They said they once did.
When did it come out originally?
About a month ago, month and a half ago.
They once did and they already don't?
Right. Well, what they do today is they order like 5 copies, and then when they sell... Well, that's it,
Yeah.
They've ordered some more. So maybe Cody's will have it. But basically, I tell people to go to my website.
So you should give your website.
Okay. www.BarbaraTedlock, one word, all small letters, .com. Authors are doing that more and more because we know, that that's the only way people can find our books, And you can choose between Amazon or, other things. And they sell for less than bookstores. So in the end, it's cheaper.
And also, this show will be archived on the website, lover.com, L-U-V-E-R.com. So if you go to the Shaman's Den archive and look for Barbara Tedlock, you'll see the website there, and you can, that's a way to get there.
Great. Websites are important.
Yes. I, G, O, I got, S, H, shit. Way back when we first started doing email, he would get shit from people that we knew in the art community because he said...
It was uncool?
Well, they said, Frank, your art is all about touching and people getting together physically and being together in community. Yeah. How can you do email?
Exactly.
It's so impersonal. And he said, everything I do is the same. And I use email the same way.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I've become an email junkie myself. I never thought it would happen. But I find it can be very intimate. You can talk with people in email.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes it happens in real time. Right. You get a message back.
Right.
Instantly. Back and forth. Back and forth.
Before you finished, just send something.
Exactly. One of the shamans that we work with in Mongolia gives out a business card. But you have to be with him in real time, and he will divine for you. Mongolia is exactly 12 hours different than here. So right now it is at 10:15 in the morning, actually. So if you're up at 10:15 at night and you want to have him work with you, he will, because he'll be up and ready to do it. But you have to be in real time with him. You don't type on, log on, and then later on come back. No. If you're not right there, then he doesn't talk to you. So that's, I think, the excitement of internet is the real time possibility.
Yes.
And shamans are using it everywhere. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Internet shamans. Frank and I are among them.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Okay, that's Barbara Tedlock and Dennis Tedlock.
Yeah.
I know we have seen you some. What years were you in Santa Fe?
70.
It was early 70s.
70. In 71?
We were there then.
Yeah, we were there.
We were there at that time.
Yeah.
We were there 70, 71, and then we went east to New York. So I think we maybe even knew.
That's kind of what Frank did, too, at that point. He went to New York.
Yeah, we did, too.
It seems to me about that time. Did you ever meet Ellen Ginsberg?
Yes.
Yes.
Was it there in Santa Fe, maybe?
That is the first time he came to the CRA crash pad that Frank was staying at.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So that's the first time you met him. That was the Center. That was called the Center in Santa Fe.
I don't remember. See, we're talking 35 years ago.
And what was the name of
him? He gave a reading in Santa Fe. I've just gotten this crazy idea that's where I saw Frank.
Did
Frank see you?
I wrote for the UN underground paper in Santa Fe.
Yes.
A.S. as the UNI unicorn. Frank was called the unicorn.
The unicorn. Uh-huh. Wow. Interesting. We probably have some of your columns. Yeah, we'll look for that. We have tendency to squirrel things like that away.
Us too.
Yeah.
That was when I F I first L E left home.
Santa Fe.
Right. That was when Louise, who that we talked about, who he didn't really know, she had said she was going to move to Santa Fe, and he said, "Boy, I wish I could."
I could do that.
And she said, "Well, why don't you just come and live with me?" Mm. And that's how he got out of the house.
That's great. Yeah. That was the opportunity.
But she took months to get there. She had said, "I have to finalize stuff with my house," and then, are we still on air? And we're okay on time?
2:15.
Okay. I have to finalize things with my house, but it shouldn't take me a week or something. I'll be right out there. So Frank, anxious to leave home,
Right away.
Hitchhiked to Santa Fe on his own with no money, with nothing, and he was at this crash pad, and it took her months to get there. So that's...
He had some real life experiences.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
Great.
That's it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.